Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
It was awful. The worst moment of all was the Buckingham Palace concert, where the poor Queen pledged allegiance to the vile new culture of talentless celebrity. Any institution that has to suck up to Grace Jones and Paul McCartney to get down with the kids has plainly lost the will to live. It is a measure of how bad things have got that Her Majesty has to pretend to like the cacophonous, semi-literate, musically trite rubbish that seems to have invaded almost every space in this country. I bet she loathes it, really. Its songs are the hymns and anthems of the modern religion of the self. Self-pity, self-indulgence, drugs, loveless sex. They are the exact opposite of the Queen's pledge, made on her 21st birthday in 1947, that my whole life, whether it be long or short, shall be devoted to your service. That was a, I think he's a journalist, is he? Peter Hitchens, who, is that right? He's the brother of Christopher Hitchens, I think.
He is, Tom, and given that you've never heard of him, that is an uncanny impersonation of someone you've never heard of.
Well, I think the character emerges from the prose. So he was right. That was Peter Hitchens writing on the Jubilee in 2012. So which one was that? I can't remember. At least track of my Jubilee.
That's the diamond.
The diamond jubilee of Elizabeth yes. II. And people will probably have noticed that this week we are celebrating the 70th Jubilee.
The Platinum Jubilee.
So the Queen very much set it breaking all records. And we thought it would be fun, didn't we, Dominic? Actually, you did. It's your idea. It's a brilliant idea to look at the history of Jubilees.
Yes, because actually the Jubilees, it was a sort of mad idea on my part. But then when we started looking into it, I think we realised that Jubilees are actually weirdly profoundly interesting because they're great punctuation points. They're the moments when Britain has stopped and sort of taken stock of itself. And actually, the really interesting thing that comes through from the Jubilees, as we'll discover in the next sort of 45 minutes to an hour or so, it's not the spectacle of the monarch waving from the balcony. I mean, that never changes and it's actually not very interesting. What's interesting are all the other things that are going on and the things that the country says about itself, where Britain thinks it is. And I think, as we'll see, with its imperial history in particular, the sort of the enmeshing of the personality of the monarch and the position of the royal family with the narrative about Britain and its place in the world is really, really interesting.
So this is a kind of temperature check.
Yeah.
On the health and fever of the nation. Yeah. You said Britain. Do other monarchs celebrate Jubilees?
Gosh, they must. The Dutch, the Danes, the Norwegians. But you know about Jubilees better than I do. So I don't even know where the word comes from.
So the Jubilees, it's biblical and it's in Leviticus. Every seventh year, so that's the yearly equivalent of the Sabbath, the children of Israel are commanded to celebrate the sabbatical year, which basically means, don't leave your fields fallow, free your slaves, all that kind of stuff. And so you have seven sabbatical years, and then the year after that, which is the 50th year, that's the Jubilee. So Jubilee is a 50th anniversary.
And don't they have Catholic Jubilees? Doesn't the Pope do something?
Yeah, so that was introduced by Boniface VIII, who was, I think we actually talked in the members episode about famous slaps in history.
Famous Do you remember slaps. That?
Famous slaps in history. He got slapped. So he was the Pope and he got slapped by people who'd burst into his summer residence on the orders of the French king. So he's Boniface VIII is the Pope before the Avignon exile and he gets into a massive bust up with the King of France. But in 1300, he instituted a Jubilee. So.
And what there's some doors when I was at St. Peter's last year, I noticed there was some door that only gets opened in a Jubilee.
Well,
I don't know why.
I'm not sure why either.
The papacy has, well, the Catholic Church has jubilees, I think, every 25 years now.
Yeah.
You can have 25th or 50th jubilees. A famous example of monarchies celebrating anniversaries was in ancient Egypt. So you have the Sed festival, which was celebrated every after 30 years, and then kind of, I don't know, 4 or 5 years after that and so on. And the whole aim was designed to restore the masculine potency of the pharaoh. So that's something that hasn't passed into our own monarchy.
Although it might have done for one of the Georges.
Although typically, friend of the show, Akhenaten, he celebrated his Sed after 3 years. Ever the rebel.
And of course, we've done the Shah's great party at the beginning of the 1970s to mark the 1 billionth anniversary.
2,500th anniversary of Cyrus.
Of the Persians. So, yeah, and actually one of the interesting things about when Jubilees first came in Britain is that in the Victorian period, there was some resistance to them because they were thought of as un-British.
But why did they come in? So it's with George III is the first, right? 1809.
So the first one is George III. So I suppose you could argue one reason they come in is simply because George III is setting sort of
breaking all records
for longevity. But also the timing, I think, is really important. So it's a very odd jubilee, this one. You might say, overseas listeners might say it's sort of typically British in that it's kind of in the wrong year because he came to the throne in 1760, but he has his jubilee in October 1809. So it's when he's entering into his 50th year rather than marking 50 years. Mm-hmm. And I think it's pretty clear that the reason that the Jubilee happens is really because Britain's in the Napoleonic Wars.
And they want to cheer everyone up.
Is yeah, and the war hasn't been going terribly well. So the British have been fighting in Flanders and that's completely bogged down. Wellington's gone off to the peninsula for the Peninsular War. But nothing has been heard from Wellington for some months, I think. And nobody really knows what's, of course, because the news takes a long time to reach Britain. So nobody really knows what's going on in the Peninsular War. Everybody's tired. You know, food prices are high. Everybody's a bit miserable. So the anniversary, so George III's 50th, is a great opportunity for people to cheer themselves up, but also to sort of feel good about being British. The other thing, of course, is that I know we have a lot of American listeners, and they may say, George III, what a terrible tyrant and stuff. But of course, that's not at all how he was perceived in Britain.
No, good King George.
Yeah, he's Farmer George. He's very, very popular, by and large, with the people.
Has he gone mad yet?
He's had episodes of madness. So this is actually one of the tragic things about George III. So this is pretty much his last moments of sanity.
It's a nice way to go out.
His daughter dies a year later, and that just drives him completely over the brink into madness, and he spends the rest of his life mad. So this is this really is his last kind of hurrah. And basically, it's very 18th century. I mean, I know it's 1809, but it feels very 18th century. So they have ox roasts in kind of towns and villages across
the country.
Plum duff, lots of beer, lots of sermons. Everybody sings God Save the King. There are some sort of nice elements. So George is quite absent because his health is so poor. I mean, he's old. He's old. He's also mentally very frail. But and there's a big fete at Windsor that he goes to with his family, and there are fireworks.
Is that the one where there's the figure of Britannia being pulled to and fro in a chariot drawn by seahorses and illumined by fireworks?
Yeah, that's right. That's
a more striking spectacle was never witnessed.
Yes, so some you do
Which
get
I find
some,
hard to believe.
Well, you do get some people writing accounts of this, so they clearly know it's a kind of red letter day. So there's an account of the celebration of the Jubilee collected and published by a lady, the wife of a naval officer. And that's the sort of one of these sort of sources that we get all this from, because obviously there aren't that many sources for this compared with subsequent Jubilees. But what we do know is military deserters, prisoners of war are pardoned, but not if they're French.
And this is being held on the anniversary of the Battle of Agincourt, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So it's the battle. So it's very like anti-French.
A kind of anti-French theme to the whole thing.
There absolutely is. Yeah. But some of the things that we now associate with Jubilees. So, for example, I mean, I've still got somewhere my silver Jubilee mug from 1977. The sort of the creation of kind of china plates and mugs and things like that. I mean, that obviously this is a time when people do love to have china mugs and plates.
And it's a kind of absolute boom time, isn't it, for the potteries? And
Exactly. And that's I mean, what the reason we do it now is partly a sort of legacy from all this. So it's a day. It's a sort of a nice sort of jamboree. But it's nothing massively more than that. You know, people don't use that first Jubilee as an opportunity for tremendous introspection. I mean, it's sort of a part.
No.
It would really be forgotten, actually. It's had a kind there of, not been subsequent Jubilees.
It's a kind of Merry England.
It is Merry England. It's very Merry England. Merry England and then going mad a few months later. Poor old, you know what, George III, it's very sad. I was reading Andrew Roberts' biography that came out last year. And he's basically spent the last 10 years of his life weeping uncontrollably and endlessly tying up handkerchiefs and unbuttoning waistcoats.
I think that they banned productions of King Lear, didn't they?
Did they?
I think they, maybe that's an urban myth.
In his biography, Roberts basically blasts holes in the thesis that George had porphyria. He says that's rubbish. He thinks he had manic depression.
And that the treatment just kind of
made it, the treatment was so harsh that just made it a million times worse. And the treatment, you know, compounded the existing problem, and that's, you know, it wasn't some genetic, you know, it wasn't some inherited kind of physical complaint, as has often been suspected. Anyway, that's a subject for another day. So that's the first Jubilee, that's 1809. And then there's a big break. So, and an awful lot changes, obviously, in the next 80 or so years. So by the time we get to number two, which is Victoria's Golden Jubilee, 1887, I mean, Britain's in a very different position then. And this is the first time that you get, I think, it's still very much focused on the monarch, but it's the first time when people are sort of slightly stopping to say, aren't we great? We're top nation, all of this kind of stuff. And you get an imperial element, I think. There had been some parties in what was then Bombay for George III, but you get the imperial element really coming through, as we shall see in a second. So 1887 is the year of A Study in Scarlet. It's the year of H. Rider Haggard's book, She. You know what Lord Salisbury gave, what the cabinet gave Queen Victoria, Tom?
I do, because you've sent it on your notes.
Yeah, I have. Hey.
he sent the Queen a picture of himself.
Yeah. very nice. So Victoria's been on the throne since 1837. And she's obviously lost Prince Albert. She's been through a great sort of trough of unpopularity, but she's just come out the other side now.
Has she? Or does this help her come out of the
trough? I think it probably a bit of both. I think she has come out of it, but it definitely helps. She has a great banquet with foreign kings and princes. So there were no foreign kings and princes for George III's Jubilee.
Well, they wouldn't be able to travel, would they?
No, exactly. But now there's all kinds of, there's the King of Denmark and there's Willy of Greece and there's all these kind of...
And presumably one of the reasons for that is not just that transport's improved and that Britain isn't at war with the continent, but also that basically they're all related to Queen Victoria.
Exactly, exactly. So already
it's a family gathering.
She's the matriarch of Europe. Yeah. Absolutely. On the 21st of June, which is the really big day, she has a parade through London, and there are Indian troops in the parade. So we'll see more Indians later on, both in this Jubilee and in the next Jubilee. But there's a big big service. The Queen of Hawaii is there, Tom.
Mm-hmm.
I know you're a big fan.
Yes, we're a big fan of the Queen of Hawaii, aren't we? Yeah.
Would you like to tell everybody the Queen of Hawaii's name? You've got the notes in front of
no,
me.
No, I don't think so.
It's Queen Liliuokalani, I think it is.
Yes.
Yeah, you didn't have the courage to pronounce it, but
well, it's because I'd forgotten what her name was. I'm going to be honest.
Anyway, the Queen has this tremendous time. Victoria, she just writes all about it in her journals, and she says, you know, I felt truly grateful, never to be forgotten day, blah, blah, my dear Albert, blah, blah, yeah. blah, blah, blah.
She has a United Kingdom dress, doesn't she?
She does, with shamrocks on it.
And roses and thistles.
So obviously the Irish question is very much in the air in the late 1880s.
Yes.
And, well, there are two elements for this Jubilee. So this is her golden Jubilee that are worth investigating. So one is Ireland and the other is India. Which do you think, what should you like to do first?
I think the Irish one is so extraordinary that you should tell people about that.
When I describe it, it will sound completely demented. Lord Salisbury, who had given the Queen a portrait of himself, part of him clearly envisaged that this might be the last gift she would ever get, because he was orchestrating a false flag terrorist bombing
attack.
Plot against her and himself, and he, themed around the Jubilee.
He told his daughter not to go.
Yeah, well, I think the head of no, it's the head of the Metropolitan Police.
The head of the Metropolitan Police did.
Told his children.
Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary.
So this is an amazing, amazing story, and it was uncovered by a guy who called Christy Campbell, who used to work for the Sunday Telegraph. He uncovered this about 20 years ago, and basically what happened was this: sort of Fenian terrorism is a big issue in the late 1880s. And sort of Irish republicanism, Irish nationalism generally is a massive issue.
But also Irish-American terrorism.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. Sort of supported from America. And Lord Salisbury, but also Parnell, the great sort of Irish sort of independent spokesman, the great sort of firebrand, the darling of the kind
the
of
the Nicola Sturgeon of...
Exactly. He's more than Nicola Sturgeon. He's the Nelson Mandela of Ireland. And Lord Salisbury wants to discredit him. And the way he does it, he thinks, well, I'll organize, you know, I'll basically organize a terrorist plot against me, the Queen, and everybody else at the Jubilee and make sure that Parnell is associated with it. And obviously, Salisbury doesn't intend for the plot to succeed. So they basically get this guy called General Francis Millen, who's a mercenary who has been born in Tyrone. And he's got lots of links with America. So he can get money and dynamite and all this sort of stuff and from people in Chicago and Pittsburgh. Millen is actually working for British intelligence and
has been for years,
yeah,
hasn't he?
So he has.
The thing that's the whole story reminds me of is it the Valley of Fear, Sherlock Holmes?
Oh, yes.
Story where it's all about undercover agents and Americans coming to Britain and engaging in these kind of plots.
That's right.
I wonder whether Conan Doyle had picked up something,
maybe, because you know, that's often because there's also is it the Orange Pips? That's about the Ku Klux Klan operating in Britain, isn't it?
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of. Yeah,
but there's a lot of this sort of stuff in the air in the 1880s and 1890s, so that wouldn't surprise me. Anyway, basically, the American Fenians provide dynamite and money and stuff, and there are two guys, Thomas Callan and Michael Harkins, and they sail to Britain from New York. And there's a bit of a shambles because they don't actually arrive. They don't arrive until the very day that the Jubilee has started. The procession has happened. They're meant to be blowing up is happening. So they're hours away. They're in Liverpool. They don't even get there until it's too late. But then they sort of just, you know, travel around Britain, making contact with other sort of little sort of units, sort of Fenian units. And that basically gives away the entire Fenian network in Britain. To the British,
it gets rolled up.
Yeah, but as you say, the head of the Metropolitan Police's secret department, who was a man called James Monroe, he did tell his children not to go to the...
And that's very Guy Fawkes, isn't it?
To the service. It's very Guy Fawkes.
Yeah.
And they did try to associate it with Parnell. So the government did say, you know, Parnell knew about this. This shows how terrible the whole thing is. And it is a bizarre that Lord Salisbury knew about it.
Mm.
And sort of, but of course the Salisburys have form with this.
I know. So exactly. So that's how I was thinking with Guy Fawkes. I mean, it goes all the way back to.
Yeah. Because we said in our Guy Fawkes podcast, we talked about whether his ancestor had really been the architect of the gunpowder plot.
Yeah.
So maybe it's just a family tradition.
Yeah.
If any member of the Salisbury family is listening, maybe they can tell us if they're planning anything this time. Now, the other thing that's really interesting about this Jubilee is the Indian element to it, because of course Victoria is Empress of India, and it matters to her enormously that there's an Indian element. And she says, basically, my way of recognizing the Indian sort of side to my life is to have some Indian servants along for the Jubilee. And they get a man who basically runs a prison to recommend two people, and one of them is this man who ends up being called the Munchie. He's Abdul Karim. And he's the son of a hospital assistant.
And he's from near Jhansi. It's the home to the Rani of Jhansi.
Who's the Rani of Jhansi?
The Rani of Jhansi is the queen who takes a leading role in what the British called the Indian Mutiny. And
very good.
Indians called the First War of Independence or something.
Right.
And she's a Flashman.
Sure, yeah, of course she is. Yeah, I knew either she'd played cricket with you or she'd been to bed with Flashman, one or the other.
So there's obviously a kind of queenly link there.
Very nice. So anyway, the Munchie comes, he's Abdul Karim. He arrives in June of the 1887, the year of the Jubilee. He first serves Victoria a breakfast 2 days after the Jubilee, and they become tremendous friends. He teaches her Urdu. He gives her, makes her curries, all this sort of carry on. And everybody else hates him, don't they? They really resent him. They think that she was infatuated with him, a bit like...
And is this before or after she has her fling with Billy Connolly?
That I don't know, actually. I'm thinking after. I think after.
Okay.
Because I think the Munchie is sort of a bit of a replacement.
Because they've had there's been two films on that, haven't there? There's been the one with the Munchie and the one with John Brown.
Yeah, that's right. And obviously she became slightly infatuated, didn't she? We know from her the way she was wrote about Prince Albert that she's quite she's a woman of strong feelings, shall we say. Yes. And yes. I think some of the correspondence was destroyed after her death, or after his death anyway.
On the orders of Edward VII.
Exactly. Probably just because it was a bit embarrassing rather than kind of... I'd be very surprised if it was kind of lewd correspondence or something. Right. Well, we're going very slowly, Tom. Very slowly.
Well, should we have a break now and then come
maybe
back?
Maybe we should have a Diamond break now Jubilee, and return for the Diamond
which is,
Jubilee.
Which is the absolute...
It's the acme. It's the apogee of Jubilees.
It's absolutely the top Jubilee. So yeah, that's something to look forward to. Okay, so we will see you back after the break. And when we come back... We'll be here with Queen Victoria's Diamond Jubilee.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
There were hussars from Canada and carabiniers from Natal, camel troops from Bikaner, and Dayak headhunters from North Borneo, wearing bright red pillbox hats and commanded by Captain W. Raffles Flint. The 17 officers of the Indian Imperial Service troops were all princes, and the Hong Kong Chinese police wore conical hats. There were Malays and Sinhalese and Hausas from the Niger and the Gold Coast, Jamaicans in white gaiters and ornately embroidered jackets, British Guiana police in caps like French gendarmes, Cypriot zaptiés whose fezes struck so jarring a chord that some of the crowd hissed them, supposing them to be Turks, and a jangling squadron of Indian lancers led by a British officer in a white spiked helmet. London had never seen such a spectacle. One of the Maoris weighed 28 stone. One of the Dayaks had taken 13 human heads. That was Jan Morris writing the middle volume of Pax Britannica, describing the Jubilee procession. And Dominic, you said before the break that this is the top Jubilee. And basically, definitely, it's the top Jubilee because it coincides with the apogee of British imperial self-confidence.
It absolutely does. So I think it's the top Jubilee, both, as you say, because Britain's at its zenith, but also because it's by far the most interesting. Because people at the time absolutely took this Jubilee as, they took it as the crowning glory of the 19th century, the sort of climax, the moment that proved Britain was indisputably top nation. Actually, and when I say people, I don't just mean people in Britain thought that. People thought that overseas.
Right, was yes, deep. They did, didn't they? So even the New York Times.
Well, I mean, the we'll get into the details of the Jubilee in a second, but as you say, the New York Times said, we are a part, it boasted, we are a part and a great part of this greater Britain, which seems so plainly destined to dominate the planet. So that's 1897. I mean, there's a brilliant poem by a guy called Alfred Raleigh Goldsmith, writing in Philadelphia. Our father's land, our mother's home, by freedom glorified. Her conquering sons the wide world roam and plant her flag in pride. For England's fame, for thy loved name, have bled, have won, have died. Victoria, Victoria, long live our nation's queen.
Yeah, that's extraordinary, isn't it? That's extraordinary. Yeah. And the Kaiser sends a telegram, and Kruger's in the middle of the Boer War, releases two British prisoners to mark the occasion. So it's it is a kind of international occasion.
Yeah. So, well, they've just had the Jameson raid in South Africa. That's the prisoners that he's releasing. But yes, so Britain is now has an empire with 450 million people in it.
And it's expanded. It's 10 times the size it was when Victoria came to the throne.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? The amount of change that has happened since she came to the throne, also obviously since that first Jubilee of George III, is astonishing. So we're now in a world of electric light, of the telegraph, of obviously of railways, of all kinds of sort of developments that are going to lead to the cinema, motor cars, planes, all this sort of stuff. Friend of the show, Lord Kitchener, is currently avenging the death of very much a friend of the show, General Gordon, mm-hmm. in the Sudan at the time.
The Battle of Omdurman is
so
looming.
Imperial sort of imperial, I mean, can I say jingoism? I suppose I the only person who's going to be cross is myself. Imperial jingoism is absolutely at its height in the late 1890s. And the sort of one of the key political figures of the time, the man who makes the weather, as people said, is the colonial secretary, Joseph Chamberlain, Birmingham man. And he says, let's use the Jubilee as basically a festival of empire. And so the whole thing must be about the empire. So actually Victoria takes although she's the focus of it, she takes a bit of a back seat, partly because she's got horrendous kind of arthritis and stuff. So she can't really join in with all the sort of activities. And you know who she has? Well, you do know because you've got the notes. So the night of the 21st of June, she has dinner with Archduke Franz Ferdinand.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing, yeah.
The Kaiser doesn't go, I don't think.
But he does, as I said, he sends a telegram.
Yeah, he's probably worried about footwear.
No, I think he'd definitely wear the right footwear to a Jubilee.
He would be
It's yachting that scrambles him. I think military possessions he's absolutely on top of. But talking of telegrams and the Imperial, Victoria sends a telegram, doesn't she? She goes to the telegram room in Buckingham Palace and...
Yeah.
The message, from my heart, I thank my beloved people. And it goes winging away.
It does. She presses a button.
Across the cables.
She presses an electric button.
To Canada and Australia and India and Africa.
Exactly.
And all the reaches of the British Empire.
And then they have this, as you described, this extraordinary parade. So, I mean, people from all corners of the earth who are sort of cheered by the crowd. The crowds have never seen anything like it. There are hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of London watching this colossal, colossal parade. Do you know what the Daily Mail said of the parade, Tom? Up they came, more
nonsense,
and more.
Rubbish.
No. They said, up they came, more and more. New types, new realms at every couple of yards. An anthropological museum, a living gazetteer of the British Empire. The Queen obviously loves all this because she loves being Empress of India. She loves being the head of the empire. There's a court circular published that says that she addressed her troops in Hindustani, which was completely made up. But when she was shown this, she said, you can print it anyway because I could have done so had I so wished.
Could she? So she learnt Hindustani and Urdu.
Maybe she'd learnt it from the Munshi. I don't know. I think actually she couldn't have done. But I think
she could have done it in Urdu.
Yeah, I suppose she could. It depends how much she'd retained from the Munshi.
Yeah. But anyway, interesting.
Yes. So
maybe if there are any experts on Queen Victoria's facility with Indian languages.
So the newspaper that I just referred to, Britain's favourite newspaper, then as now, they had a special edition printed in gold ink. For the daily, special golden edition of the Daily Mail. Every edition's a golden edition, Tom.
Very vulgar. Shouldn't it be printed in diamond?
It should have been printed in that. Do you know what their editorial said? How many millions of years has the sun stood in heaven? But the sun never looked down until yesterday upon the embodiment of so much energy and power. Deathless prose.
I think Augustus would perhaps disagree.
But there are two really interesting sort of side notes. So one is Joseph Chamberlain, who had orchestrated the whole thing, he's a big believer in protectionism, in imperial unity, all this stuff. And he hosts a colonial conference as soon as the Jubilee is over with the 11 prime ministers. So 11 places, Newfoundland, New South Wales, all these sort of places have sent delegations. And they have this great meeting. And he really wants a permanent imperial council. He wants basically an imperial federation that will create a greater Britain, a genuine greater Britain. And they basically don't go for it. So that's a bit of a dog that doesn't bark.
Because they want to keep their autonomy.
Because they want their autonomy. And so even there, at the height of Britain's power in 1897, this moment that, as you say, Jan Morris takes as the centerpiece of the entire book, Pax Britannica, the Jubilee, as the moment when Britain's power was greater than it ever would be again. Even then, I think there's a sign that actually the sands of time are kind of...
Well, yes. And so the most famous literary product of this Jubilee is a poem by Rudyard Kipling, who is, of course, famed as the Laureate of Empire. And at the time is seen as the kind of the voice of Britain.
Yeah, absolutely.
He sums up the imperial mood, the imperial spirit in his short stories, in his poetry. He's probably the most famous writer in the world.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair.
And he gets asked by the Times to write a poem to mark the Jubilee. And the poem that he writes isn't at all what people have been expecting, because it's called Recessional, and it's basically a warning to Britain that it will all vanish. And so the famous verse in it: far called our navies melt away, on dune and headland sinks the fire. Lo, all our pomp of yesterday is one with Nineveh and Tyre. Judge of the nations, spare us yet, lest we forget. And that was prompted, I think, by him seeing a kind of review of the Royal Navy at Spithead, and he was blown away by it, and then felt this kind of presentiment of doom, hubris and nemesis.
It's one of the fascinating things about Kipling, isn't it? At the same time as he is extolling the empire, and he absolutely believes in it, and he is the poet laureate of empire. But at this high point, he writes this poem that is absolutely shadowed by impending doom, loss, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, of course, he does celebrate empire, but he is also he far from whitewashes it.
He's very alert to the
Dark side to it. I mean, he's a brilliant writer. We should definitely do an episode on him.
We should, because you know the poem that he originally started writing,
Burden.
The White Man's Burden, is the poem he started writing in the Jubilee year, and then he ditched it and then reworked it during the Spanish-American War when he sent it to Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
But I mean, the message of the White Man's Burden is utterly different from that of... Yeah. And that's the fascinating thing about Kipling, that he clearly believes both things equally. He believes in empire, but he also knows that it's transitory and that it's flawed and all this sort of stuff. And I think that's what, you know, why sometimes people sort of diss Kipling and they say, oh, he's just a sort of crusty old reactionary. But obviously that's what...
But this, I mean, that poem, Recessional, it's a poem that is equal to the irony of that British imperial apogee.
Yeah.
I mean, it's beautifully conveys the mixture of hubris and looming nemesis that obviously at a century more distance we can absolutely see in it.
I think, and the other reason it works so well is even at that moment in 1897, Britain is being overtaken by the United States and Germany economically. So even as people are wearing ever fancier hats and sort of cheering empire with ever more gusto, the sort of... beginning to fall behind.
I mean, I wonder if there isn't a rule of imperialism, that the more ludicrous the hats worn by imperialists or the headwear, the nearer to disaster it's coming.
I'm sure that's true, because actually the people who are the imperialists in the 1890s are all about spectacle, pomp, pageantry.
Swagger. Well, the whole thing, I mean, the whole thing is a kind of confidence trick, isn't it?
It is. Exactly. Of course it is. But of course, the people who had built the empire were not really into that, because they were hard-nosed entrepreneurs trying to make money and you know, they wouldn't have had time to do parades because they were too busy, you know.
But it's all a kind of slight hint of smoke and mirrors about that.
Definitely.
The whole shebang. Definitely. Which means that by the next Jubilee, that is becoming very evident, isn't it?
So the next Jubilee is actually a sort of bit of a poor relation of Jubilees. It's a friend of the show, George V, stamp collector, creaser of his trousers at the sides rather than the front and the back.
Very knocked much out in the first episode of the World Cup of
unfairly, I thought, because I really like George V. He's one of my favourite. I like a boring king, and he's a very boring king.
He's so boring.
Yeah, but his boringness is interesting and really important.
Like the Queen's.
So, exactly. So, George V has steered Britain from the First World War through the Depression, and it's just coming out of the Depression now, 1935. It's his silver jubilee, so 25 years. Monarchy has had a really tough time, obviously. And if you think about his family, the Kaiser has been booted out in Germany. The Tsar has been executed in Russia. But the British monarchy has succeeded by making itself quite humdrum. And he's his humdrumness is what makes him popular.
So I do like the embroidery kits that were given out that sum him up thus: Prince of Sportsmen, brilliant shot, but happiest aboard his yacht.
Yeah.
Where, of course, he does wear the right foot, the right shoes.
Well, he's a stickler. I mean, he wouldn't let people come to Buckingham Palace if they're in the wrong shoes. And I'm not making that up. You know, you had to wear the right stuff. Mm. So it's not as big as a blowout as the other Jubilees. There isn't really so much of an imperial dimension, certainly not in terms of the parades, although, of course, his Jubilee is celebrated in parts of the empire. Because it's the Depression, there is a little bit of a shadow. So there, in places where there's high unemployment or there's a strong sort of left-wing political presence, it's not as well supported as elsewhere. So, for example,
are there kind of active demonstrations against it?
There aren't really demonstrations, but for example, there's a place in Fife called Lumphinans, I think it's Lumphinans, where local communist councillors oppose celebrating the Jubilee and sort of make a fuss about it and say they're just a bunch of royal parasites. So there are hints of sort of criticism, which there absolutely were not in 1897. George's own speech mentions the Depression. So he says, "In the midst of this day's rejoicing, I grieve to think of the numbers of my people who are still without work. We owe it to them, and not least to those who are suffering from any form of disablement, all the sympathy and help that we can give," and all this sort of stuff. So there's an acknowledgement of the kind of tough economic times. And he's surprised. He's famously very surprised when he goes on this sort of tour of London, the East End and stuff, and people are cheering and waving flags. And he says, which again, something that I think is very endearing. He says, "I had no idea they felt like that about me. I'm beginning to think they must really like me for myself." And which is quite sweet, I think, and quite self-knowing that he knows.
But do you think that's true?
I think people did like him for himself, actually. I think they liked his
pooterish quality.
Yeah, his pooterish quality, exactly. Mm. And actually, I think this is a very pooterish Jubilee, and that is the point. Because it's only, I was having a look when I was thinking about this Jubilee, it's only a few months. So it's the previous September. The Nazis had held the Nuremberg rally that Leni Riefenstahl filmed for the Triumph of the Will. And the contrast between that, you know, with the amazing light shows, with the choreography, the cinematography, and then this. I mean, the best thing about this Jubilee is they invent an ancestor of coronation chicken.
And they name a chimpanzee Jubilee at London Zoo.
Yes. So in other words, it's so small scale and mundane and kind of sweet that in a way that kind of – it's a rebuke to the sort of strutting swagger of Mussolini or the
Well, I wonder whether because for the dictators, and particularly for Hitler, the assumption is that fascism is the face of the future. It's powerful, it's dramatic, it's visual, and that the democracies are mired in decline and are shabby and dull.
Yeah.
And it's the difference between a crisp, you know, Nazi uniform and Chamberlain's wing collar, basically.
Yeah.
You know, it's fun, you know, umbrellas against whatever the Nazis have.
Well, it's
kind of turbo missiles or whatever.
Exactly. What it is the difference between that footage you have of crowds at Nuremberg who are beside themselves with excitement, screaming at the top of their lungs and doing their Nazi salutes, absolutely invigorated and energized. And they're kind of, you know, in Leni Riefenstahl's kind of framing, they are prime specimens of humanity. And then meanwhile in London, there are people with terrible teeth eating pies under some bunting.
Because
and of course, the poor pie people are going to win.
Because there's, I mean, there are two things that the British traditionally have liked to think about themselves, which might seem contradictory. And one is that they don't like to make a fuss, and that waving flags is for, you know, we don't obsess about flags, and that's for foreigners. And the other thing is that we do royal processions terribly well.
Yes.
And they're obviously completely contradictory.
Yeah.
But I guess that this Silver Jubilee in 1935 perhaps, squares that particular circle, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it does, because it's sort of flag waving in an understated way, isn't it?
Yeah,
Apologetic way, which is also true of the next Jubilee, the Silver Jubilee in 1977.
Which I can actually remember.
Yeah, it's one of the very first things I very vaguely remember. So how old were
nine.
You?
I was nine.
Yeah. There's a photo on my website of myself at the Silver Jubilee. Waving
Looking
a flag.
Patriotic?
Yeah, I'm waving a flag.
Of course.
At the age of about sort of...
Though it continues.
Three or something. Yes, exactly. So this is one of the first Jubilees where it inaugurated the tradition of everybody saying nobody will go. It'll be a terrible disaster.
because no one can express... No one can sum this up better than you. 1977... I mean, if 1935 was a bad year for Britain...
Yeah.
Relative to other countries. 1977 is a terrible year.
Yes, it is a bad year. So we've just been bailed out by the International Monetary Fund the year before, in 1976. In 1975, we'd set our post-war record of 26% inflation. So Jim Callaghan is prime minister.
Seemed to be broken, perhaps. Who knows?
Who knows, exactly. We've got a Labour government. They have a very funny discussion captured in Tony Benn's diaries, where Benn wants to give her, he says, what should we give her as a present? He's got a great idea of a vase. He's got a vase that's been carved by a Polish miner, and he thinks something like that carved out of coal would go down well with them. And it's got to be something that reflects the values of the labor movement. James Callaghan, who's very patriotic and an absolutely staunch monarchist, sits through this kind of smiling through gritted teeth, and then basically gets his wife to go off and buy the Queen a silver coffee pot, for which each member of the cabinet has to pay £15.
Good.
As a contribution. It's like as if the Queen didn't have a coffee pot already. So obviously this is the Jubilee most famous really for the Sex Pistols. But I think it's probably true to say that most people are not of the Sex Pistols persuasion, although the song sells, you know, tons and tons of copies. Because there's a great – when the day comes, as it always happens with Jubilees, there's a great sort of outpouring of sort of patriotism and jollity and stuff.
And there I learned from you – from your notes, there were even special Jubilee editions of Penthouse, Mayfair and Forum.
Very 70s.
Did your researches lead you to...
No, I've never got... I bet you can get them on eBay. Though I think it's a slightly weird thing trying to stop
Again,
me on
if
eBay.
If any listeners out there have copies of the special Jubilee editions, I'd be very interested to know.
Of Penthouse. There's lots of people are wearing Union Jack pants and all this sort of stuff.
And this is the golden age of the tea towel, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely the golden age of the tea towel. So they do have Republican events. There's a rally organized by the Libertarian Communists at Blackheath, but only five people turned up. So that wasn't a great success. But actually, when you look at as I said before at the beginning of the program, what's really interesting is what people say about Britain. So the Times, complete contrast with what newspapers had said in 1897, says this is its leader. It says the popular imagination can no longer feed on the glories and wonders of empire, nor, it has to be admitted, does the Britain of 1977, relieved of almost all its imperial baggage, present the sort of spectacle to lighten the mind, the bonfires of national rejoicing. And Time magazine had a very similar sort of piece. They're looking from America. The past quarter century has witnessed enfeeblement and decline. The end of an empire, the shrinking value of the pound, near stagnation of a formerly innovative economy. It's this grim reality that the Jubilee briefly banished, but it will still be there to challenge Britons when their party is over. So the Silver Jubilee, which I remember quite fondly because it's basically the first thing I can ever remember, the sort of village fete and stuff. I think it's a great party, but there's a real sense of it being a moment of escapism. And what's
it rained.
Otherwise, yeah, exactly. It rained.
It rained.
It's an otherwise fairly miserable sort of story.
I suppose as well as Sex Pistols, Derek Jarman made a film called Jubilee the following year.
Oh yeah,
It had Toya, it had Adam Ant, and the plot is that Elizabeth I is transported by John Dee,
right,
into the present, and it's kind of Britain absolutely is worse with fires and drizzle. And I think somebody's just murdered Elizabeth II. And the Queen kind of goes around and there are loads of punks.
That's very Derek Jarman.
Yeah. I mean, nothing particularly
happens.
But it's
also very late 70s, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very late 70s. Yeah.
That sort of bleak, drizzly, miserable kind of
thing. Yeah, I mean, so Jubilee is the 1977 equivalent of Kipling's Recessional.
Yeah.
So there'd be an interesting essay there.
That's a very good essay, Tom. I think you should write it. So let's move on to the next Jubilee. We've got two more to go. 2002. Remember 2002?
They all blur.
They do blur, don't they? The last two definitely blur.
I remember about that, or maybe I'm muddling it with the funeral of the Queen Mother, but there was, again, there's this great right royal British tradition of saying it's all going to be a disaster and they'll be interested. And then actually there were massive, massive crowds.
Yes. Well, this is what happens.
And I remember going out thinking they were, you know, not even really being aware that there would be crowds, not even thinking about it, to go and get something, and finding myself just unable to move because they were so packed.
So the Guardian had great fun in the first half of the year saying what a terrible disaster the Jubilee was going to be. Wave that flag and open that champagne, says its columnist John O'Farrell, because for a decade now nobody has cared about the monarchy. Hooray, we won't have to hold a street party and blah 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 blah. And then the Guardian published an editorial saying kind of ha ha ha, there aren't going to be any events. The list of events bears a forlorn look. So far, it lists a Golden Jubilee snooker and pool tournament in Plymouth. The planting of an oak in the village of Oxhill, Warwickshire. The planting of a Jubilee garden at Cranmore Infant School in Shirley, Birmingham. The placing of small fountains all over London and precious little else. And of course,
was there anything else?
Well, there was, because there were these huge concerts in London.
Yeah, but were there any permanent memorials?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, so the Guardian was right.
No. No, because what everybody remembers that Jubilee for is Brian May.
Yes, I do remember Brian May.
Brian May on the...
But it's not the equivalent of a great, mighty, flourishing Golden Jubilee, whatever it was.
Well, you obviously stand with Peter Hitchens here, don't you?
Who?
It's Peter Hitchens, who you obviously don't know who he is. But he agrees with you that a rock concert is not appropriate and it's not a...
No, I have no problem with rock concerts.
So here's the thing.
I'm just standing up for the Guardian, because you're sneering at the Guardian for having said that there are no permanent memorials. And I'm
saying it didn't say there are no permanent memorials. It said there were going to be no good events.
Okay. All right. Okay. I take it back.
That's what it said.
I take it back.
And actually what happened is, first they held a classical concert, the Prom at the Palace, and 2 million people applied for tickets to go, and 12,000 went. And then they have this party at the Palace, which is really the first time, other than Elton John's appearance at Diana's funeral, that the House of Windsor had wholeheartedly embraced kind of British pop culture in that way. So Paul McCartney is there and Eric Clapton is there and whatnot.
Well, and regular listeners will remember my brilliant rendition of Paul McCartney singing Her Majesty.
But more people watched that, interestingly, than watched the Live Aid concert.
That is such a Sandbrook fact.
Yeah, I love that.
That is such a Sandbrook fact.
So more people watched that, and also far more people watched the next concert in 2012. 200 million people watched that concert around the world. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. The Queen, of course, she was present, but she wore earplugs.
She wore earplugs, yes. And but the best thing about that concert was Johnny Rotten, John Lydon.
Yeah, he's great. He's a reformed customer, isn't he?
Well, I mean, he truly is the greatest punk. Because he obviously hugely enjoys puncturing punk.
Yeah.
Which is the most punk thing to do.
Yeah.
So Charles is a really good bloke who talks to plants. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yes, he now says
he's not advertising butter.
He then said, when I heard William had popped the question to Kate, I had a nice cup of tea for them. that's a spirit of 1977.
Yeah.
So anyway, I think that was a very important moment, because the monarchy had been through this big dip in popularity with the death of Diana, and their apparent sort of inability to emote in public and to sort of reconcile themselves to the modern world. And basically, the people who organized the Jubilee in 2002, I think the guy was called Sir Michael Peat who organized it, incredibly clever kind of spin doctoring, because they basically decided to harness the energies of pop and make
everyone love that.
And everybody, they knew everybody would love that. And, you know, it just worked incredibly well to sort of revitalize their image. And that's what they basically did again 10 years later with the Diamond Jubilee, which is the most recent one, 2012. So that was the middle point of a trinity, wasn't it? So you had the Kate and William wedding in 2011, and then you had the Olympics in London.
So yes, that was the summer I hit my six.
Was that the summer? So that was the fourth part of that.
Yeah. So four amazing.
Mighty events.
Mighty events. And I went to see, because I had a friend who had a special berth on the Thames to watch this flotilla of ships go by.
Oh, yeah.
And it was designed to look like a Canaletto, wasn't it? Lots of Tudor-type ships.
It poured with rain, didn't it, during the...
It didn't just... I mean, it hailed and sleeted and it was icy. And the poor Duke of Edinburgh had to stand there for kind of 3 hours and he got a chill on his bladder.
That's right, he had a bladder infection.
And it was... I mean, I thought it was the most admirable thing. I watched as the Queen and Prince Philip went by.
But do you
absolutely
remember...
kind of rigid. Standing to attention.
The big story of that Jubilee was the BBC's coverage, which was absolutely mocked and derided because they didn't treat the river pageant with the
Well,
respect.
That was it, wasn't it? That was...
They had ill-informed commentary, which called the Queen Her Royal Highness instead of Her Majesty, and everybody went absolutely ballistic.
Did top columnists in the Daily Mail
write
trenchant, punchy pieces on this?
They didn't, because... I had to go down to that Jubilee. I had to. I didn't have to, but I did, to be a pundit on the BBC's Jubilee Roundup. And for some complicated logistical reason, I got there an hour too early or something. So they said, sit in here at the back of the sort of control room where the producer, who had been outed in the Daily Mail and other newspapers that day and condemned as a traitor to the realm, where the producer, who was called Ben somebody and was a very media person with kind of precisely glasses. The right kind of trendy glasses, was sort of sweating and shouting at his underlings and just generally an absolute wreck. And all the underlings were smirking because they had clearly been reading the papers with great enjoyment to see him utterly eviscerated by the tabloids. So anyway, that was good fun. I enormously enjoyed that. But that Diamond Jubilee that was basically a sequel to the Golden Jubilee. It was more pop music, more of the same, which is, I guess, what they're doing this time, isn't it? There's going to be lots of concerts and, I don't know, is Ed Sheeran involved in some way?
Isn't Tom Cruise doing something?
Tom Cruise has done it.
Oh, has he? What did he do?
He spoke in Slough or something.
What?
I can't remember.
Even Windsor.
Well, it might have been in Windsor. I mean, I don't know. He did something. He spoke. He looked, as he always does, you know, suspiciously young.
That completely passed me by.
Yeah. Tom, you're not following Tom Cruise's activities with the attention to detail that I would expect. So what are you doing for the Jubilee, Tom?
You know my commitment to getting this book done so that I can do more episodes of The Rest Is History.
So actually you're sacrificing yourself.
I'm sacrificing my ability to share in the mood of national jollity for the good of this podcast.
Are you a great man for street parties?
I'd certainly go to one if it was being laid on, but I wouldn't organise it. Are you?
No, I'm not actually. That won't surprise you at all.
You hate Right Royal Flummery, don't you?
I just don't like public jollity.
No.
I don't mind a bit of, I don't mind. I like it.
A bit of bunting.
I don't mind a bit of bunting. We have some Union Jack bunting, actually. It won't surprise you to know.
Well, I imagine Arthur must be very excited.
They're doing a thing. I'll tell you what they're doing at his school. They're doing a day where everybody, each class has chosen a country of the Commonwealth, and they're going to dress up as that country.
That's very 1935.
Right. And they're going to go as a member. And he came home and he said, well, we've got an absolutely excellent one. And I said, who are you dressing up as? And he said, Mozambique.
Right. Which has just joined.
And I thought...
Commonwealth of English-speaking nations.
It has joined, I think, hasn't it? I think Mozambique has joined, although obviously it was part of the Portuguese Empire. But I foresee, well, I think that needs to be sensitively handled, dressing up as Mozambique.
Yes, yes.
Because I obviously said, well, are they expecting, you know, a load of Justin Trudeau-style costumes? And clearly they're not, because that would not be the thing. But I don't know, because I don't want to send him in. I don't know what Mozambique traditional dress is, and I don't want to prejudge it in case we look, cancelable.
Yeah.
Well, what would you do faced with that dilemma, Tom?
What, having to go...
As Mozambique.
As Mozambique. It's a good question. I have no idea. I don't really know anything about Mozambique.
Well, if listeners have potent thoughts about Mozambique dress...
Wildlife, perhaps? Go as a giraffe?
Go as a giraffe? Do they have giraffes in Mozambique?
Don't know. Well, elephants. They have elephants. Well, go as an elephant.
You could go as an elephant. I mean, this is very 1897, isn't it, ultimately?
It is. It is. I mean, I think that the risk with celebrating a jubilee is that in decades to come, the photographs will come back and haunt you.
It depends how you're attired, though. If you're just wearing a nice sort of paper Union Jack hat. Sorry.
A Union Jack waistcoat.
Yeah, if you're wearing a Union Jack hat, you'll be absolutely fine.
No, I think you've been embarrassed. Because as you said, you hate public displays of jollity.
Yeah, but I'm not going to be doing it. I wouldn't wear a Union Jack hat.
No, I'm saying you wouldn't want that.
No, but I wouldn't go out. I mean, I'm not going to go out.
So what, you're just going to kind of hunker down?
Yeah.
Refuse to have anything to do with it? Are you going to watch the concert?
No, I'd watch the I'd watch the Queen waving from the balcony, and then I might...
Well, we all want to see if Prince Andrew's going to be there, don't we? I mean, that's the massive great floater.
I will be waiting with pen poised to see what Harry and Meghan are going to do.
Yeah, so are Harry and Meghan going to be allowed there? And will Prince Andrew be released out of his dungeon? So Dom is saying that Harry and Andrew won't appear.
No, they're not welcome.
Is that absolutely official?
That's our producer. Yeah, he's saying, I think it is official that they're not involved.
Okay, so well, Tom, what's your favourite? Diminishes the excitement of it.
What's your favourite Jubilee? If you could have gone to any of these Jubilees, well, you did.
Oh, 1897.
Yeah, 1897.
I mean, it'd be amazing sort of spectacle and show.
I like the thought of the ox roasts and the French.
The plum duff.
Yeah, and the sort of francophobia.
Yes, of, and the warm beer of Old England.
Yeah, I think that would be it.
But I think you could have had that in 1897 and seen loads of headhunters.
You could, yeah, that would have been it. Yeah, and you'd have, you know, read your golden ink edition of the Daily Mail.
I wouldn't. I'd have read it in the Times.
Would you?
Read Kipling.
Well, you know what Lord Salisbury said about the Daily Mail in 1896, 97.
I assume something disapproving for boys, isn't it?
A newspaper written by office boys for office boys.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we've done the Jubilee justice, Tom.
I think we have.
So we've done multiple Jubilee episodes, yep. Which I think is what the
It's been a
wants.
Right royal podcast. you've done Her Majesty proud. We hope you, if you're celebrating, that you enjoy it. If you're campaigning against it.
We hope you don't. Then, then we wish you ill.
No, I think it's an opportunity for everyone to enjoy themselves.
Oh, no, Tom. This is the kind of appeasement mentality that I absolutely will not stand for. Right.
So
enjoy your street parties.
Enjoy street parties. Have a lovely time.
If you're not lucky enough to be British, you probably haven't been listening anyway. So.
But I'm sure they'll be celebrating in Australia and Canada.
Or maybe the Americans will be reading that poem.
That would be good, wouldn't it? Actually, Dominic, for our American listeners, do you want to just take us out by reading that poem again?
Our father's land, our mother's home, by freedom glorified. Her conquering sons the wide world roam, and plant her flag in pride. For England's fame, for thy loved name, have bled, have won, have died. Victoria, Victoria, long live our nation's queen. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.